For this and all Clinical Updates podcasts, a 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit will be available for a limited time. To claim credit, view the slide deck associated with this podcast and complete the evaluation found in the slides. Speakers, planners, and CME staff do not have any relevant financial relationships with ineligible companies to disclose.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Clinical Podcast. Today, I have Johnny Steffens, who's a certified nurse midwife who works in Menopause and Sexual Medicine Central Care. Of course, Johnny, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me. We are going to be talking about menopause. What is the definition of menopause? Which happens to everybody who's a female and is lucky enough to make it through menopause years.
So I think there's a couple of different ways to talk about menopause and two ways that we use that word. One of them is just this umbrella term that basically includes everything from, you know, kind of starting in our late 30s to early 40s, where hormones are starting to change, all the way to the end of our life. That's menopause. Now, that includes a lot of different stages. But if you were looking at the true definition of menopause itself, it is defined by the day. So it's one day only when we have gone 12 consecutive months with no bleeding, or the day that we had our ovaries removed. That's menopause. And then we are forever postmenopausal after that time.
So, okay. Now, let me ask you a question. When you mentioned the different stages, which we'll talk about in a second, would it be fair to say that the perimenopause before, right, the premenopause or the beginnings of the menopause potentially are the worst for the person? Because I think it's not only new symptoms to you, but you're like, oh, shoot, I'm there, I'm getting old, and now all the things that maybe cross your mind. How do women take it?
I think women are mad, to be honest.
Okay. Okay.
And I will tell you why they're mad, because they are so ill-prepared for menopause. Nobody's talking about it. You know,
they
their
talk
moms
to you when
don't...
you're a kid about
puberty,
yeah. But not about this.
Well, yeah. So I think women now, especially in today's world, are just angry about the fact that they are ill-prepared for this time in their life. I will agree. I think perimenopause is the most disruptive part of the entire experience. It also comes at probably a really difficult time for a lot of women, because women in their 40s are oftentimes still parenting. They may have aging parents they're trying to take care of. They're at the peak of their career. They have a lot of life demands. And now all of a sudden they are going through puberty in reverse.
Puberty in reverse. But then you're not a kid after that again.
Right.
That ain't fun. Okay. I wanted to ask you a question right off the bat, and this is purely non-scientific. I saw these commercials for medications for moderate to severe menopause or something along the lines of that, something on medication to ameliorate the symptoms. Are we putting too much social stigma on menopause and making it harder than it truly is by talking a lot about it and it's a real deal and et cetera, or... is the opposite? We were completely ignoring it, and now we are doing the right thing in saying, look, this sucks. It's a bunch of years in which you feel bad and is something heavy.
So prior to the 2000s, from about, you know, the 1960s up until 2000, when menopausal hormones first came out, women were very routinely automatically prescribed menopausal hormones, you know, when they became menopausal.
By menopausal, you mean that birthday,
usually that they stopped bleeding. So yeah, it may not have been that they were still perimenopausal. And then with the release of the Women's Health Initiative study, or WHI, in 2002, you could hear toilets flushing across the world because everybody was flushing their hormones and providers had stopped prescribing them. Fast forward now to 2025, we have an entire generation of women who were never afforded the opportunity to manage their symptoms and get through this period of life. And we have an entire generation of medical providers who did not get any training on how to identify menopausal symptoms and to treat them appropriately. Women's health is also, you know, underfunded, menopause in particular. And if we don't fund it, we're not going to resource it. So it's a combination of women aren't, weren't talking about it, providers weren't trained, and we weren't really putting a lot of money in this aspect of healthcare. And we are still dealing with the consequences of the early 2000s.
But tell me about that consequence, because the WHI was supposed to be a favorable thing for women, but then we stopped prescribing medication. What changed? And the recommendations changed or something like that?
So WHI was launched not to look at the efficacy of menopause hormone therapy, because that had all been, that had been well established up until that point, but what they had been seeing anecdotally and in observational studies is that women were doing better, especially from a cardiovascular perspective, when they had been using menopause hormone therapy. So the question became, we don't have any RCTs on looking at using menopause hormone therapy for chronic disease prevention. And that's why they launched it. So they were specifically looking at endpoints cardiovascularly. And then because we're talking about women, a secondary endpoint was breast cancer. There were two arms to this aspect of this study, which was huge. There was one arm that was on estrogen only because they did not have a uterus. And then there was the second arm that was on estrogen plus a progestogen because they did have a uterus. Each one of those arms had a coexisting placebo group. And what happened in 2002 is that the estrogen plus progestogen arm was terminated early because of an assumed increase in breast cancer risk.
Why you say
they had a big press conference, which is unprecedented with research studies that you're going to be on the Today Show. Yeah. It was done before it had been finally reviewed by the investigators, before it had been peer reviewed, and before it had been published. And it has been reanalyzed many different times and many different ways in the last 20 years. Plus, we have additional studies that have been going on as well. And even though they terminated that study, that arm of the study early, they continued to follow those women for 18 years. So we also have 18 years of follow-up now on them. The problem with, you know, hearing there's a 26% increase in breast cancer risk is that, understandably, people panicked.
You cannot ring a bell.
Yeah, I mean, they panicked on that. And none of the reanalysis or the data that came out after that, you know, had a press release. Nobody was, you know, on TV talking about it at this point. So everybody's still kind of marinating in 2002, and the data is much different.
So tell me, what is the data now? What do we know?
So what do we know? So first of all, I think we need to look at some of the limitations. And one of them was the way the study was set up. So the research participants that were recruited for this study were 50 to 79 years old. That was that older range was specifically done because we're looking at cardiovascular and you know, other kinds of risk factors. Sure. The average age of those women were 63. Mm-hmm. This is a completely different population than we really are treating in today's world. We're treating these perimenopausal women, women in their 50s, women who are, you know, close to the time of menopause. We generally are not starting patients on hormone therapy at 63. So that's one thing to recognize. Yeah, is that we had an older patient population. The other thing to...
But hold on, was it well matched or it was not well matched to the placebo?
It was matched to the placebo age-wise, yeah.
It was well matched.
Yep.
So then so the increase was true. The issue is with the age, the population.
So that was one aspect of it. So the other things to be aware of is that in the placebo groups, they included women who had previously used menopause hormone therapy. They just weren't on them during the study. When the breast cancer... risk came out, they only talked about that it increases risk. Well, again, this was only in the estrogen progestogen arm. In the estrogen only arm, there was not an increase in breast cancer. And in fact, there was a decreased risk in breast cancer in the younger women. So then you kind of had to think, well, was it really the estrogen? They were using exactly the same estrogen in both study arms. Was it the progestogen that was making the difference? And there's been a lot of conversation around that. And I think we still maybe have some unknowns on that area. The other thing that I tell people when I'm talking about that these participants is that in the estrogen plus progestin arm that showed the increased risk, the placebo group had an unusually low risk of breast cancer.
Selection bias.
Part of that is because they were previous hormone users.
Oh.
And if you
so they
took
were protected
out,
by the previous estrogen they used.
Yeah.
And they were less cancer. That's kind of a funny observation.
So even if you take kind of the data as it is, and you look at absolute risk, which is different than relative risk.
Yeah.
The absolute risk is 4 women per 1,000 per 5 years of use.
Fantastic. Because that was my question. 26% could be like the placebo had 1 and the other group had 3. So right. Was it well powered? Was it, it wasn't, 26 was the absolute, but what were the numbers? It wasn't that. I presume the numbers were pretty low on both arms of breast
cancer.
Yeah,
I don't know what the exact numbers were, but yeah. So the absolute risk came out to be 4 per 1,000 women.
Versus placebo.
Yeah.
Okay.
So a placebo group, I think, is 3 per 1,000 if you're looking at, you know, kind of baseline. So they went up to 4. So if you look at that, that is a rare risk. If you look at what, you know, kind of is that definition of rare risks.
That's why I always say, let me make a parenthesis here. I hope everybody knows this, but I always tell students and residents, I say the most important part of a paper is not the results, but the methods by far.
It was a great study. I think it gave us a lot of good data. You know, people will talk about the types of hormones that were used. Well, they used the types of hormones we had at that point. We used conjugated estrogen and medroxyprogesterone, which are really not as commonly used now. We have many more formulations to use for patients. I mean, they're still available on the market. Again, even with those medications, you have to look at the risks. And you also have to think about timing, because these younger women starting on hormones within 10 years of menopause, do well and do better.
But let's say for a second that there is a risk for increased cancer, minimal as is. So what you're saying, if you do it from 40s to 50s, or you start in late 40s, 50, you just use it for a decade and then you back off, and then the risk is much lower than if you do it later in life?
So, you know, part of it is the initiation time period, not necessarily the age you are when you're continuing. So what is the general expert opinion at this time is that if you have a healthy patient who is in within 10 years of menopause, they are going to not only experience excellent symptom relief related to their menopause, but they're going to get some additional chronic health benefits, including in that age group, a decreased risk of breast cancer.
And cardiovascular disease or not?
It's also good for cardiovascular, yeah. Yeah. It's okay. The older women. So if you're looking at starting a 60, 65-year-old, 70-year-old, yes, they would still get benefits from symptoms if they are still
late.
Having them at age, but we're not getting the other chronic health benefits. And it's not necessarily that it's too late or there's, you know, just by virtue, significantly higher
risk.
There's
not enough time to see the results.
Not going to get all the benefits, because it makes sense that a 70-year-old is already going to have chronic disease at that point.
So let's look at it from a different perspective. What are the contraindications to the use of estrogen?
So the other thing that I like to make sure that everybody understands is that when we're talking about menopausal hormone therapy, we're talking about two different kinds of hormones. We're talking about systemic, which are dosed high enough that we're going to increase estrogen levels. That's what makes your symptoms better. And then there are the localized or the vaginal estrogens, which are not going to raise your estrogen level and are only going to work on the genital and urinary tracts. So we need to separate
those
out.
Which we talked about in a in a separate podcast for
right.
GMs.
So yeah. If we're just kind of generally talking about menopause, most often we're talking about systemic menopause hormone therapy. So the contraindications to systemic menopause hormone therapy is going to be unexplained vaginal bleeding. We need to kind of investigate what's happening sure. in that patient. Having had a hormone sensitive cancer, now I will put a little caveat on that. There are some cases where hormones might be used. So but I tell in general, we're not necessarily starting systemic hormones on those patients. Patients who have active cardiovascular disease, patients mm-hmm. who've had an MI, a stroke, patients who have an inheritable clotting disorder, or patients who've had a DVT. And then they say active liver disease as well, but that's also got a little bit of a caveat because actually in patients with Hep C and fatty liver, menopause hormone therapy seems to slow right. liver fibrosis.
Okay, so let me stop you there for a second because estrogen reduces the risk of cardiovascular disease. So why having had cardiovascular disease event is a contraindication or a relative contraindication?
So I think in general, when we're talking about cardiovascular disease and the risks associated with that, oftentimes we need to kind of piece apart the different formulations. We're definitely going to see much higher clotting risks with oral estrogens than we will see with some of the other transdermal topical vaginal products. And that's just because of how metabolism happens in the liver. That's where we develop our clotting factors. And as we get older, we have higher risks of clots in general. So as of yet, those remain the FDA contraindications. Certainly, there are nuances to all of those.
And you mentioned vaginal bleeding. Do they increase the risk for uterine cancer?
No, if you are prescribing it appropriately.
Okay.
So vaginal bleeding in the perimenopausal and postmenopausal, particularly phase, that is always something we need to investigate because it's not normal for somebody to start bleeding after they haven't bled for, you know, a couple years. So just in that case, in and of itself, you need to figure that out.
So these are postmenopausal women speaking in the sense of the last time they had a bleed.
Yeah, postmenopausal bleeding is never normal. It always needs to be evaluated.
Not the dysmenorrhagia they had before going into menopause.
Yeah, so the perimenopause, okay. It gets a little tricky about how yeah. abnormal it is, or is it just perimenopausal hormone fluctuations that's happening? Mm-hmm. But if a woman has a uterus and we are doing menopause hormone therapy, you need to be giving her a progestogen to counter that unopposed estrogen, which is going to thicken the uterine lining, potentially lead to endometrial hyperplasia and increase her risk of uterine cancer. So okay. that is where the risk of uterine cancer comes in, is if you are giving her estrogen and you are not giving her a progestogen.
Okay. Is there any benefit in estrogens counteracting the osteopenia and subsequent osteoporosis?
Absolutely. That's one of the indications for using menopause hormone yeah. therapy is not only vasomotor symptoms, but the prevention of osteoporosis. Menopause hormone therapy, again, you have this window of opportunity. It can be very beneficial, not only just around bone resorption, but helping with maintain bone density as well.
So if I hear you right, I'm going to echo the other podcast we did on GMS and topical estrogens. It is not only a symptom relief deal, but it also protects women for those things that once the estrogens go, their risk goes up. So we should use it because they live longer and it will protect them longer to use estrogens.
So I don't think I would go for, you know, as far as to say that 100% of women should be on menopausal yeah. hormone therapy. Uh-huh. I mean, this is what I do every day. I think it becomes down to kind of individual circumstances. But I think, sure. again, there is this window of opportunity that we have, and we can help symptoms, but we can mm-hmm. also attenuate some of the other age-related things that are happening or the consequences to our heart and our bones that happen when we don't make estrogen anymore. And I should throw out cognitive as well, because the brain is also sensitive to that loss of estrogen.
Yeah. Okay. Now, last question. Are there any other non-estrogen therapies for symptom relief? Anything?
So there are. particularly for vasomotor symptoms, the hot flashes, the night sweats. You can use non-hormonal pharmaceuticals if a patient is not a candidate for estrogen or if she's choosing not to take that. Those medications are not going to work as well as estrogen does, and you're not going to get the other benefits that you do with estrogen. There are, you know, some other interventions that can potentially be used as well. I think you can never underestimate the just taking good care of ourselves, optimizing our health, optimizing our nutrition, our physical activity, our sleep, our stress, our social connections. Those are equally valuable strategies and measures that we can take as well.
Thank you so very much, Joni. Have a lot of many other questions, but in the interest of time, I'll refer people to you, of course, and to the great slide deck that you attached to this presentation.
Thank you.